Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. I've not really made many videos about the wars in Africa. The videos that I've made are videos that related to very specific things that I wanted whites to know about. So that's why I made those videos about Angola and what happened in Angola, was because I wanted whites to grasp what happens when blacks and whites really get stuck into each other, when it's really all out, no holds barred warfare. So I've not actually done much detail about the Rhodesian War. I've done bits and pieces about it. I've never discussed the war in Mozambique. But the elephant in the room is that I've never really discussed the South African wars, the wars of South Africa inside the country, outside the country, the borders, and then of course the huge battle, the enormous battles for Angola. So just because I haven't made videos about those things doesn't mean that I have no knowledge about those areas. There is one South African video that I did do a long time ago, and that was based on what my friend Gilbert told me, and that was the important video of how the army in South Africa in the 1990s managed to control the blacks. What people don't know is that right to the end of white rule in South Africa, right to the end of white rule, the whites were never defeated by the blacks. The Boers were never defeated by the ANC, or anybody else, actually. And they beat them, they smashed them on multiple occasions. But there are so many topics, there are tons and tons of topics relating to all these wars that we whites fought in Southern Africa. There are mountains of topics, actually, that need to be attended to. And I did start on parts of them. There are sections that I started that I never finished. And lately, as I'm going through videos, I'm actually looking at the things that are partially completed. Because between the Portuguese and the South Africans and the Rhodesians, and then of course there are the Southwest African whites, who I almost never mention, but they also fought intensively. But Southwest Africa was controlled by South Africa. So South Africa and Southwest Africa, to me, are virtually one nation, controlled by the South Africans all the way. But there are tons and tons of stories to tell and military lessons to learn from all of these conflicts. So stick around. We're going to talk warfare in Africa like you've never seen. Plus, in the not too distant future, I will be getting going on the gods of war, because there are so many lessons for whites to learn. And in this age where race war has been brought to us by Jews, communists, and liberals, Jews being the prime movers and the prime stokers of racial conflict, and they've opened the doors to racial conflict. They not only opened it here in South Africa and in Africa, but they opened the doors in America, and white Americans are going to have a hot time in the years and decades ahead. So all of these topics from Africa have got a lot of relevance to everybody. Even whites in Europe are going to find themselves having freaking racial conflict on their own doorstep. Places like Sweden, where the whites were happy, the whites were at home, the whites were so peaceful, so bored with themselves because everything is so peaceful, and then Jews, like that disgusting, filthy Jewish hag, Barbara Spector, coming and bringing all these non-white scum into Sweden who are raping women, killing people, causing mayhem. So who could have imagined that Europe, which is so white and has such a big white population, is going to find itself drowning in all kinds of non-white garbage? And you're going to see that all of this behavior is biological, that everything that happened to the whites in South Africa, to the whites in Angola, Mozambique, Rhodesia, the Congo, Kenya, you're going to find that absolutely everything that we lived through, you are going to live through. It's going to happen right on your own doorstep. But don't hassle about it, because we whites in Africa, we fought the blacks a lot. Nobody knows the blacks better than the Boers. The Boers have spent almost 400 years here in Africa. Nobody knows the blacks better than the Boers. And nobody is better positioned to deal with them than the Boers. And we whites have fought the blacks so much, we know them well. But there are questions about why we lost. And there is a deeper question about why even Americans lost various wars. A particularly important war is actually the Vietnam War. And lots of the fighting that took place in Vietnam and even Malaysia with the British, all of that stuff has got a lot of bearing on this issue of racial conflict and how to fight it. So there's a hell of a lot to talk about. And even topics like Vietnam are topics that I will turn to at the appropriate time, because there are so many parallels between Malaysia, Vietnam, and then what happened in Africa. It's all pretty much the same thing. And you'll discover that all of these wars, whether it is Vietnam, whether it is the Korean War, whether it is Malaysia, whether it is Africa, you'll find that the people that are stoking the war against the West are either the Soviet Union, the Russians, or the Chinese. It's one of those two groups that are stoking each one of those wars. Wars do not just happen by themselves. Wars don't happen by themselves. They never happen by themselves. A war is a complex and very expensive thing to do, and war never just happens. It doesn't just happen. And the blacks that we fought against, the blacks were not fighting us with spears and clubs, or, to use the proper term here in Africa, a nobkiri. They didn't come at us with clubs and spears and stones. They came at us with AK-47s and hand grenades and rocket launchers and stuff. And they didn't make those things. They didn't even know how to operate those things. All these wars are funded. They are funded. They are supplied with proper modern weaponry. The weaponry is made in factories. Those factories were either in the Soviet Union or in China or in Eastern Europe in the times of the Warsaw Pact. But those weapons were manufactured in factories. They were put on planes or ships, and that's how the blacks got them. And the blacks themselves were thrown on planes and sent off to be trained. Wars never happen by themselves. There's a lot of logistics and organization that goes into it, even for the blacks. All those blacks go into classrooms and they are taught. They were given lectures, they were given training, they were taught how to fight, what to do. They were taught everything. I mean everything. They didn't know their ass from their elbow. They didn't have the faintest clue how to fight us. There were people who came and taught them in classrooms, lectured them, armed them, trained them, etc. And there are people who like to say, oh, well, you see, the Soviet Union isn't Russia. The Soviet Union isn't Russia. But that's not true. The Soviet Union, where was the capital of the Soviet Union? The capital of the Soviet Union was Moscow. And Moscow has always been the capital of Russia. The Kremlin, which is in Moscow, was where the government of the Soviet Union was, and it is the Kremlin that is where the government of Russia is today. And if you look at the Russians might not be the only group in the Soviet Union, but the Russians, I've gone and checked, the Russians make up about 70% of the population of the Soviet Union. And the Russians came to Africa too. They were around. The Russians were key players in Vietnam. I've noticed that people are extremely ignorant about so many wars. And Vietnam, when the Americans fought in Vietnam, they weren't fighting the Viet Cong, who were armed with sticks and stones. The Viet Cong were armed with freaking machine guns and AK-47s and all kinds of weaponry. And where did it come from? Well, it came directly from Russia, actually. The Russians and the Chinese armed the Vietnamese, but the Russians played a huge role in Vietnam. And so it wasn't just a case of the American army is going to kill some villagers. The parallels between the Vietnam War and the wars in Africa are very, very similar. Two wars that are almost identical is Vietnam and Rhodesia, or Vietnam and Angola, or Vietnam and Mozambique, because the terrain of Angola, Mozambique, and Rhodesia was very similar to that of Vietnam. Whereas South Africa is a different story. South Africa is amazingly powerful, insanely powerful. And we will discuss the South Africans in coming videos. And I will show you things about South Africa that will stun you. If you think that the white South Africans, especially the Boers, were some kind of losers, you're an idiot. You have no clue what really went on or how good the South Africans really were. And I want to tell you straight off, if you think that the South Africans were beaten on the battlefield, the truth of the matter is that none of the whites of Southern Africa were actually beaten on the battlefield per se. But the one group of people who smashed their enemies, not once, but multiple times, are the white South Africans. And at the heart of the firepower of the white South Africans are the Boers. The Boers were a key player in South African wars. Even though there were a lot of English here, but the Boers did lots of the heavy stuff. There were English who were high-ranking generals. There were English who were in all kinds of parts of the military. They were allowed anywhere. The Boers allowed any whites to work and live and move upwards in South Africa under apartheid. The Boers are racialists, and they allowed and gave other whites opportunities in South Africa, and they treated people the same. And I came here and I benefited from that myself. I spent a short time in the South African Navy. I worked in a parastatal, the post office. That was how I got going in South Africa. And if it wasn't for those things, I would never have had a chance to move forward in life. So, did apartheid work for me? You betcha. It worked for me. And it worked for every other white person in South Africa, including English speakers and including ungrateful Jewish scum. But let's turn to the topic of today's video, which is specifically aimed at Rhodesia, but it's also something that relates to a bigger topic, a deeper topic that I've pondered for many years now. It is the topic of the white man and his tools, the white man and his weapons of war. And how is it that a race of people like ourselves, who have such technical genius and such technical skills, how is it that a race like ours, with the genius and the work ethic and the discipline is important, eh? A people like us who've got fantastic tools, who have a lot of discipline, who are hardworking, who are clever, who are able to respond to all kinds of nasty, nasty situations. How is it that a race like ours can find ourselves losing wars? And it's not just us in Africa. Probably the best example of total defeat was the American army in Vietnam. The American army went in there with heavy weaponry, and with weaponry the likes of which no army has ever fought any non-white people. And the United States Army got its ass kicked in Vietnam, and they had to pull out there with large casualties. There were 50,000 Americans that were killed in Vietnam. 50,000 Americans died in Vietnam. That is an insane amount of people to die in one of these third world countries. That must be the nastiest loss that whites have ever had fighting a third world people. Admittedly, the Vietnamese are not low IQ like the blacks of Africa. They might be a small people, but they're a clever people, and they had determination. But how could they defeat an army that was so powerful, that had such incredible weaponry? Now, we in Africa suffered from a similar thing, but on a much, much smaller scale. We didn't have much in the way of weaponry, and our weaponry compared to the American army is like very, very simple. But even so, even with the little bit that we had in Africa, why did we end up finding ourselves losing ground to blacks over time? And with my interest in the Rhodesian War, it was one of the first things that I always pondered as the years went by. I always kept asking myself, how was it that we could be so good at some things, and that on other levels we find ourselves going backwards? And I'm going to tell you the nasty answers in videos to come. What is it that's the real weakness of whites? There is a weakness, and that weakness will come out, and I'll explain it to you. And it's not technological, it's got nothing to do with being stupid, it's none of those things. Also, another thing about the African wars that's got a lot of relevance to whites everywhere is that despite Portugal having countries in southern Africa, the South Africans having control of more than one country, the Rhodesians being around, despite us having different countries that did have certain different rules, we actually worked together amazingly well. And people don't know this, but we had a secret military alliance. This is a unique discovery that I made in recent years. I just about fell on my back when I discovered it. And the whites of Southern Africa had a secret military alliance to help each other. And that alliance was created long before the heavy fighting even started. And among the debates that take place among ourselves, even now, is who are our possible friends? Well, I will show you who our friends were. And I can tell you up front that the only friends that the whites in Africa ever had were Europeans. The only friends that whites in Southern Africa ever had in our worst situations were actually Europeans. Europeans and the Japanese, can you believe? Those were our only friends, but I'll return to that topic as a separate issue. So let's just take a quick look at some background for people who are not familiar with the Rhodesian War. So that map shows you how the black terrorists infiltrated Rhodesia from all sides. And you can see those are the routes that they used. The dark arrows are the routes in the early years of the war, and then later, after 1974, those dotted lines are the additional routes. And Rhodesia was about the size of France. It's about the size of modern Germany. So you've got 250,000 whites, which is a teeny-weeny little population of whites who live there, and 6 million or so blacks, and we are fighting in a country the size of about Germany. So the population density is very low, and large parts of the country are just African bush, and blacks are living in huts here and huts there and so forth. And there are some places, like in the east, that are mountainous, that are really quite mountainous and quite nasty. So the nature of this war is a war with groups of blacks moving in, chatting to blacks in villages, living in areas, moving around, and conducting attacks on civilians. They're attacking farmers, they're laying landmines on roads, they try to ambush cars driving on roads. Ambushes are actually quite an important part of the Rhodesian lifestyle, where you could be driving down a road and there are blacks with AK-47s and machine guns actually lying in wait in the bush by the side of a road, and they can open fire on you with AK-47s and machine guns while you're driving in your car. That happened. It never happened to anyone in my family. These ambushes were mostly done on roads and rural areas that were far away from the main roads. So these blacks were most successful in the deep rural areas, and that's a very important lesson. They never could penetrate the cities or even the small towns. Warfare is much more complex than people realize. And as I do videos, I want to explain to you political things, international rules and laws, and many other things that relate to fighting. Because fighting is not just about the guys who've got the weapons. It is a lot deeper than that. There's a lot of strategy and a lot of decisions and a lot of things take place in a war. A war is a very complicated exercise. War is not only extremely expensive, but it's very complex. And it's really a very incredible mind game that goes into warfare. And if the strategic and political decisions at a high level have got any kind of weakness, then it will impact the soldier on the ground. And the soldier on the ground will end up losing. But he'll lose not because he's a bad shot, not because he's stupid or lazy, but he will lose because of other bigger things that are happening. So keep listening as I describe many things to you in all sorts of videos as we dig into this topic of warfare, because the topic of warfare is a topic that every white man on the planet must study. You must understand war. War is a very critical thing because the world is a world of war, and war will never go away. It will never go away, and that's actually not a bad thing. What we don't want is whites going to war against other whites. But when it comes to racial enemies, people whose DNA and genetics is not the same as us, then war has got tremendous possibilities. And you only have to look at the Aryans and the Romans and lots of other whites in the past, the Vikings, etc. You go and look at what whites in the past achieved, even the British Empire. You go and you see what war has achieved. And war is a thing that is necessary on this earth. And there are certain kinds of people, like racial enemies, where you are wasting your time. You're wasting your time when you're busy just talking. And these are topics I will return to. So anyway, that gives you an idea of the terrain of Rhodesia and the kind of problem. So the whites are sitting, controlling Salisbury, which is the capital in the middle, and the whites are trying to retain control of this country that is the size of Germany. So you've got all these blacks coming in and hiding here and fighting in this way and that way, but the thing is to hunt them down, find them, and kill them. And then, of course, these blacks have got bases, big bases, outside the borders, sitting in other black countries where they are ostensibly safe. And all those things make for a very complicated type of strategy. And Rhodesia had lots of strategic problems. And one of the things that comes out of this, and that's important in warfare, is how much money does it cost you to kill your enemy? How much money does it cost you to kill your enemy? And even the Americans, even all kinds of modern wars, you'd be shocked at how much money it costs to go and kill one of your enemies. You'll fall on your back if you saw how expensive it is. It's actually a hell of a costly thing. It really costs big amounts of money. And even if you've got high tech, it costs lots of money. And that is an area of thought that I've been thinking about a lot, because that is the kind of thing that killed us in Southern Africa, especially in the case of Rhodesia, where the economy just can't handle it. And I did do a video about how the Rhodesians could have survived, and that was a special video that does exist. How we could have survived if we changed our strategy, and could we have beaten the blacks just by ourselves? I did do a hypothetical video on that topic. But let me repeat, people are very hard to kill. People are very hard to kill. Even stupid people, even weak people are very hard to kill, because when you need to kill people, you'll be amazed how fast they can run and how quickly people will flee for their lives and the desperate measures that humans will take. All humans will take desperate measures in order to survive. Killing people is actually much more difficult than you realize. Let's turn our attention to this group of chaps that you see here on the screen here. All these photos are of guys who are in the same military unit. And this military unit is the Selu Scouts. Selu was actually a white hunter who came and hunted in Africa, and he hunted especially in the area that is known as Rhodesia. I think Selu was also a hunter of elephants. So this was long before the whites came and settled there. So anyhow, they named a unit after Salu, and the Salu Scouts became one of the elite units of the Rhodesian Army. And the reason we are going to be looking at the Salu Scouts is because it was claimed and has been thought for a very long time that these guys killed the most of our enemies of any unit. So let me explain a little bit about the Salu Scouts. In the top right photo, you'll see white guys, and you'll actually see blacks among them. And the Salu Scouts was this kind of unit. It actually was composed of two-man teams where you had white guys and blacks teaming up. You had a white man and a black man working together. But they did change the way they worked at various times. Anyhow, these whites and blacks worked together, and they actually did something that is illegal in modern warfare. In Western warfare, it is an agreed upon principle that you are not allowed to dress in the uniform of another country and pretend to be a soldier from that country. So if, for example, somebody dressed in a German uniform who wasn't in the German army, and that person then went and attacked Germans, that would be a violation of the rules of Western war. I did a video about that, about the Russians dressing in German uniforms and attacking Germans, and how the Germans survived. That was an instance where they did it on a big scale. But in Africa, the British actually started this kind of thing. And the correct military term for it is pseudo-operations. Pseudo. And pseudo-operations is when you pretend to be the enemy and you sneak around as if you are them. And you use this to cause confusion and to kill the enemy, to lead them into traps and to kill them. So the British did this initially in Kenya. And this kind of concept, by the way, is very much a police type of approach to warfare. It's not the normal standard type of thinking that normal military people would do. Normal soldiers and normal military don't really do this kind of stuff. It's more police kind of thinking. But police kind of thinking can be freaking awesome, okay? It can bring results. Now, the British did this a lot in Kenya. And this concept was actually pioneered in Rhodesia by a guy called Ken Flower. Ken Flower is a very important man, and a man that is hardly ever mentioned. But I've dug into the stuff that Ken Flower did, and he's a very, very fascinating character. Ken Flower later became the head of the CIO, the Central Intelligence Organization of Rhodesia. In other words, the top spying organization. But Ken Flower was an Englishman, and he'd been a policeman. And Ken Flower was actually the guy who started pseudo-operations. Before they created the Salu Scouts, Ken Flower was training blacks and sending blacks, just blacks alone. He was sending blacks to go and infiltrate other blacks and to kill other blacks. And he did it for years. And he set up blacks who would be trained by the Russians or the Chinese, and then when those blacks start heading off to come into Rhodesia, then among those blacks would be his pseudo-operators, who were themselves black. So he had blacks who went out along with other blacks who were genuine blacks who wanted to fight the whites. he mixed in these blacks who were actually secretly working for the Rhodesian government. And then those blacks would come with their other buddies that go through all the training courses, and then they'd be given weapons, and then they'd start traveling and marching to come and infiltrate Rhodesia through a border. And then what those other blacks don't know is that among them are Ken Flowers guys. And through various mechanisms, either those blacks would turn on their buddies and kill them, or there would be sneaky stuff that is done to lay traps for those blacks, and those blacks will be led into a trap where they'll be killed. And Ken Flower was amazingly successful at this for quite a few years. For quite a few years, all the blacks that were being trained in Zambia, all of them were killed even before they got into Rhodesia. They were killed outside of Rhodesia. They just freaking disappeared, man. They would be trained, they'd get their weapons, they'd set off in their units to go to Rhodesia. They would never arrive, and nobody would ever hear about them, ever. Nobody would ever hear anything about them, ever. And the various armies and camps where they came from, those blacks would lose contact with them, and nobody would ever know that they just disappeared. Well, Ken Flower and his blacks were killing them all. And they were insanely successful. So it was actually Ken Flower who wrote various memos and came up with the idea that they should form a proper unit in the Rhodesian army to carry on these pseudo-operations. However, when they did form this unit that became known as the Zulu Scouts, they brought in a guy who had been retired, a guy called Reed Daly. He'd been a very successful soldier, and he was excellent, and he'd just retired. And then they decided to ask him to come out of retirement and to lead the Zulu Scouts. And Reed Daly had a penchant for also wanting to brag a bit and to also talk a bit too much. And the Zulu Scouts started getting known during the war. And Ken Flower actually hated it. Ken Flower hated that people even knew that the Zulu Scouts existed, because in his typical police and spying fashion, he wanted a unit that was totally secret. This unit must be so secret, nobody must even know it exists. And unfortunately, the Zulu Scouts also got involved in cross-border raids. And if you look at these guys in this picture on the left, you see these white guys standing by a bus. Those are Zulu Scouts, and notice their faces are blackened, etc. Those are Zulu Scouts. Also notice they're not using Rhodesian Army uniforms. So they are dressed like the way the blacks would dress. The blacks, believe it or not, you see that guy on the far left, that white guy on the far left with the big beard? You see that guy's wearing jeans. The black terrorists actually liked to wear jeans. So jeans was actually almost like part of their uniform. So these guys next to the bus, these are all Rhodesian Zulu Scouts. They're white guys. If you look at them, you'll see they are white guys. But notice, they also have AK-47s, which is not what the Rhodesian Army uses. And in the bottom right picture, you'll see there's also another bunch of Zulu Scouts. You'll see white guys. Probably one of the giveaways of whites and blacks, other than their eyes and their lips and so forth, is that they need to hide their hair, because their hair will stand out. So it won't be the black curly hair And so all these white guys have to wear hats, because that would also be a dead giveaway to them. So all of these guys, they've got their faces blackened, but they are Sulu scouts. But returning to the top right photo, inside Rhodesia, these blacks and whites would function in teams, and they would go into the bush for long periods of time, and they would sneak around and secretly try to make contact with the real terrorists, and they would try to lead them into ambushes where they kill them. And either they lead them into an ambush where they kill them, or they get the army and the air force to come and kill them. So that was pseudo operations inside Rhodesia. But then these same Sulu scouts then started doing cross-border raids into neighboring countries, and then that is where they got a lot of publicity. But the real reason for them existing was actually to just do that secret stuff inside the country. And they were good at it, and they killed a lot of blacks. Now, in the final days of Rhodesia, in the very final time of Rhodesia, I remember hearing this on the radio myself when I was a teenager. Right at the very end, as we were busy finally handing over to the black communists, one day on the radio, there was a very strange story. It was on the radio and it was published in the newspapers as well. And the story said the following. It said that of all the blacks who'd been killed in the war, of all the terrorists that had been killed by the Rhodesian Army and the Rhodesian Air Force, that 70% of them were killed by the Sulu scouts. That these guys had killed 70% of all of the terrorists. And it was a bit of a disconcerting announcement, because we had lots of other units. We had the Special Air Services, who were our special forces. We had the Rhodesian Light Infantry, who were the main fighting force. And then, of course, there was the Air Force. And so there was something about this that had a bit of a strange and almost demoralizing ring to it, that the Sulu scouts were the main killers of all of our enemies. And I heard it, and I sort of thought, yeah, okay, you know, if that's the fact, then that's the fact. And this then went on to be mentioned again and again in all the books that were written by the various military officers who wrote books in the 1980s about Rhodesia. And this came to be a commonly accepted fact, that the Sulu scouts were the main killers of all of our black enemies. And I believed that. I myself believed that. And by the way, this method of using blacks to kill blacks, there might be a similar method that others used. And the other term for this is Askaris. I think the term Askari is also a term from use by other whites in other parts of Africa for using blacks against blacks in a similar way. Now, the most important tactic that evolved in the Rhodesian army as the war got going and as the war hotted up was the thing that is depicted in this painting. What this is this is known as fire force. And the basic concept was the Rhodesian army would either track terrorists, or the Sulu scouts would tell them, listen, there's a group of terrorists over here, this is where they are, we need to attack them. And so it came to revolve around this business of using helicopters to bring in some troops. These helicopters, by the way, couldn't carry many troops. They could carry very few troops because these helicopters were small and they could only carry like about three or four guys at the most. And then the helicopter could hardly take off. Anyhow, these helicopters would come, two or three of these helicopters would bring, you know, anything from 6 to 10 guys. And then these guys are dropped on the ground, and the helicopters also have got machine guns, and they then set about fighting these blacks on the ground. So the helicopters circle, and they drop these small groups of whites, and then later on in the war, they started bringing in other kinds of aircraft. Maybe if they need a bunch of guys, they'll bring a Dakota. Like if you look there in the top left, you'll see a Dakota dropping off some parachutists, and then there are other little aircraft that also come in to bring in firepower. So the Rhodesian setup was very small compared to the kinds of stuff that South Africans and Americans could do. And so with this combination of teamwork of dropping a couple of troops on the ground here, helicopters circling, the helicopters and the troops being in contact with each other, then they basically try to encircle these blacks and they try to stop them from running away, and they kill all of them. And this actually is known as fire force. And this became the most common method of fighting the blacks inside the country and killing them. And as the war hotted up, especially after 1974, as the war hotted up, fire force became a permanent thing. They had fire force troops at various military airfields. The helicopters and stuff would be there, and everyone would just be called out from one fire force action to the next. And there would be troops who would fight in multiple fire force actions in the same day. I think the all-time record for troops fighting in multiple battles on the same day was 9. I think that was the Rhodesian record for guys who are picked up by helicopters, dropped into a fight. As soon as the fight is finished, they pick them up again. They go and drop them into the next fight, and so it carries on. My own brother did some fire force on one of his camps, and he'd been in the Rhodesian Army for a long time before then, and he'd been in the SAS, so he'd been a special forces soldier. And my brother did one camp where he was in fire force. And when my brother came out of that, he said to me it's the most hectic thing he's ever had in his life. And he said he couldn't believe that young 20-year-old guys were being chucked into this. He said this would really mess with your head. He said this was freaking crazy. He thought this was the wildest, most lunatic way of fighting, but it was freaking effective. It was very effective, and it killed most of the blacks. It was an extremely effective method of combat. And if you watch armies, all armies watch and monitor other wars, and they learn from other wars. And I want to tell you that I think that fire force, that the United States military basically functions on its version of fire force when it went and fought in the Middle East. When it went and fought in Iraq and Afghanistan and all those places, the method of fighting that the United States military works on is basically the American version of fire force. But it's way more powerful because they bring in jets and really heavy stuff. And so you'll see the principle is the same. They'll have like a small group of Americans on the ground. They'll be in a base or they'll be in vehicles, and they'll run into an enemy force, and then they just call in the aircraft, the helicopters, the missiles. Next thing you know is these others are being just ripped to pieces with heavy, heavy firepower. So the American version of Fire Force is about 1,000 times more effective than Rhodesian Fire Force. But it's exactly the same principle. Small group of troops, find the enemy, call in the air and the ground, they just smash it to pieces. In the case of the Americans, the air power is so tremendous that they blow up tanks and everything. They destroy everything. So in the case of Rhodesia, it was just fighting man to man. But in the case of America, they bring in the air power, and the air power will wipe out everything on the ground. They'll wipe out the tanks, they'll wipe out artillery, they'll blow everything to shit in no time at all. So this system of ground and air combat is a very important one. The South Africans also had their aerial gunships, and they used their aerial gunships in Angola and in Southwest Africa to also bring firepower in. But in their case, they didn't really have to worry too much about needing men on the ground, because often they had much larger numbers. So they didn't quite need to do the Fire Force thing exactly. And they also had jet aircraft, so they would also bring in their aircraft as well. But they definitely had this aerial component as well, but just not as finely tuned as it was in Rhodesia. And Rhodesia's Fire Force evolved. It started with basic Fire Force, and then later on towards the end of the war, they had things they called jumbo Fire Force, where it was more complex and heavier stuff came in. Because by then they were fighting larger and larger groups of blacks. And the goal was to kill everybody. You can kill everyone. You can surround them and kill them, and hardly anyone will escape. It's a very effective method of fighting. And the blacks feared it tremendously. And it's a virtual death sentence. So most of them are not going to come out of that alive. They'll be killed. It'll take some time. When my brother was in Fire Force, he told me that one Fire Force action that he was in, they fought 30 blacks, and he told me it took them the whole day. He said they went out in the morning, and they were busy fighting all day long. It was only late in the afternoon that they'd managed to catch and kill all the blacks. Because there's lots of bush, etc., and the blacks are hiding, and it's a hectic story. He said the whole freaking day, they didn't stop for tea or lunch or nothing. They were just on the go the whole freaking day. He said it was the most hectic thing he'd ever been in his life. And he even told me the story of how he got a watch. My brother got a watch from a dying black. There was a black who was like the commander of the blacks, and in the radio transmissions, the guys in the Fire Force, the officers in the helicopters who are commanding this whole thing, they figured out who was the main black guy, and they decided, and they saw that he was injured, and my brother had to go and grab hold of this black guy and drag him to a place where the helicopter could pick him up. And as he pulled the black's arm came off. The black's arm had been partly shot off, and as he pulled the black, his whole arm came off. Anyhow, armless or not, my brother had to drag the guy to a point, and the helicopters pick him up. And what they do with blacks like that is they give them some kind of medicine, and they sort of half look after them, because even as they are dying and they are wounded, the whites are already questioning them about the other blacks in the area. So even if these blacks survive, or if they die during the trip or whatever, the whites are already getting information, because those blacks can often tell them stuff, and then they've got additional intelligence. Oh, okay, there are other blacks over there in that location. We need to go and hunt them down there, and that kind of thing. And so when my brother pulled the guy's arm off, the black guy had a really nice watch, And so my brother took the watch off this guy's arm and he kept it for the rest of his life. And so my brother had a really smart watch that came from this freaking dying terrorist. But it's pretty hectic stuff. But this tactic of ground and air, worked like a bomb. And if the enemy needed more pounding and the helicopters couldn't quite do it and the light aircraft couldn't quite do it, then they would call in a jet aircraft to maybe come and blast them with rockets or drop some bombs or something if it was very hectic. So fire force became the main form of combat as the war carried on. And the fire force bases, there were more of them and they were busy all the time. They could have very hectic days as the helicopters are coming and going and the troops are off. This bunch of troops are off to this fire force action over here. That group of troops is off to that fire force action there. The commanders are deciding, you know, which groups need to be attacked first. The whole day is a hectic day. And in the very final years of the war, probably like the last 3 years of the war, this became a very, very hectic form of combat. This was going on all the time. And I must tell you that as a kid, I saw these helicopters all the time. On our farm, it was a common sight for me to hear that noise of those Alouette helicopters. And I would often run out of the house to go and just watch as an Alouette gunship flies over our farm. Mostly they would fly just one helicopter at a time, but there would be times where maybe two of them fly by. And sometimes they were flying so low that you could actually look up and you'd see the gunner, you could see the gunner sitting there, you could make out the gunner and the pilot, and you'd know that they're off to go and kill some blacks somewhere. Mostly because of the place where we lived, the helicopters would be flying out to the east of the country, or coming back from the east. But if they're flying off to the east, then I would know they're off to go and shoot some blacks. Or as the Rhodesian guys referred to them, they called them the gooks. They used the same term that the Americans used in Vietnam. They called them the gooks. Returning to the Rhodesian military in general, in this montage that you see in front of you, we've spoken about the Selous Scouts there on the top left. And we're going to talk a bit about the Rhodesian Air Force shortly. But the Rhodesian Army had lots of units. These guys on the bottom left in this black uniform, these are actually the RLI. This was a whites only infantry unit, the Rhodesian Light Infantry. They also, can you believe, had the nickname the Saints. I don't know how they got the nickname the Saints, but this is the Rhodesian Light Infantry. This is the hardcore whites only unit. This is the most professional of the military units, of the normal army units. And the RLI did tons of fighting. So they were doing fire force and all these other things. They were doing lots of fighting. But they were doing it according to normal Western European principles. These were our proper troops. They didn't do weird things. These were our proper guys, the RLI. And the rifles that the Rhodesian Army used is the NATO FN, the Belgian FN. That was the main rifle of the Rhodesian Army. The South Africans also used that, and they called it the R1. But then the South African Army, being the awesome thing that it was, it went and did a whole bunch of other stuff. It started creating its own rifles, the R4, the R5. They did very seriously advanced stuff. Rhodesia also had some artillery. I haven't got photos here, but they were old British artillery pieces that they used from time to time, later on with cross-border raids and things. The problem with artillery is that you need something to shoot at, and you can't bring a cannon hundreds of miles into the bush because you're busy chasing down 10 blacks. So the Rhodesian artillery was used either at border posts or other places, but mostly in cross-border raids. They started using the artillery. There were certain times when there was enough need for firepower for battles that were going to last more than one day, and then they would bring in those old British pieces of artillery and they'd pound the blacks. And can you believe some of that old artillery once even knocked out a Russian tank? There were blacks in Mozambique, and it was actually the government, the black communist government's tank, and they sent this tank to come and support the blacks that we were fighting, and the old artillery cannons popped a freaking tank. In terms of armor, because of the difficult terrain, armor didn't work in Rhodesia. But we had this kind of armored car. We had even smaller armored cars, much, much tinier things that were British. But this pretty cool little armored car that you see there is known as an Eland. But actually, it's not Rhodesian. It's actually French-made and modified by the South Africans. The South Africans modified this French armored car and put a bigger gun on it. And then in the way that we whites in Africa worked, we would rename these things and give these animal names. So this was called the Eland, but it's actually a French vehicle enhanced and upgraded by South Africa and Rhodesia. I don't know the rules by which Rhodesia got it, whether we bought it from the South Africans or whether they lent it to us. I don't know the full details. But we had a permanent force of Elands, so I suspect that there must have been a permanent arrangement there. And they also played roles later in cross-border raids, some of these Elands. So that was our main heavy armor. We didn't really have tanks. Later we did have a couple of tanks, but that's a story for another day. But the Elands were the heaviest firepower of our armored force, and they were used on certain occasions. They probably had a lot more use than the artillery. So you should get an idea that Rhodesia had quite a varied military force, a force that had a little bit of everything, and there were also police units that also went and did fighting against terrorists. When you listen to J.B. Campbell and he talks about PARTU, PARTU is Police Anti-Terrorist Unit. So he was officially a policeman, but a policeman who actually fights like a soldier. So as you can see, we had all kinds of firepower, and we will discuss this issue of who killed the most blacks shortly. Let's take a closer look at the Rhodesian Air Force. Here is a chart of the main aircraft of the Rhodesian Air Force. And the Rhodesian Air Force may surprise you, and it is the strangest of all the air forces that existed here in Africa. And it's nothing like as fancy and as potent as the South African Air Force. The Rhodesian Air Force, in total, from the pilots to the members of staff to the guys who worked on the aircraft to their entire staff complement, the Rhodesian Air Force was only 1,000 people. 1,000 people. And all the people who flew the aircraft and repaired the aircraft were white. So it was 1,000 white guys, whether it was the gunners, whether it was the guys who repair it, whether it was the pilots, all of it, white males only. And so the entire Air Force was 1,000 strong in terms of people. In terms of aircraft, there were some jet aircraft that had been bought from Britain in the days when we were a proper colony of Britain. So there were some old aircraft. The really oldest jet aircraft were Vampires, Vampire jets. And most of the Vampires didn't fight. But they actually managed to get some of those Vampires into combat, even in the 1970s. Some of those Vampires actually saw real combat. But the two jets that really did the heavy lifting when it came to the most important fighting were the Canberra Bombers. The Canberra Bomber is bottom left, and you get a side view of the Canberra Bomber there. And then the closest thing we had to our super weapon, which is not in this drawing here, is the Hawker Hunter. That was the closest thing to our jet fighter and ground attack aircraft. The Hawker Hunter was the most special aircraft we had. And none of our aircraft could go supersonic. And the Hawker Hunter could only go supersonic in a dive. So it was in no way comparable to the South African Air Force. When I came to South Africa, the South African Air Force, the entire staff complement of the South African Air Force, the pilots, the guys who repaired the aircraft, and all the guys in admin and all the various guys in the bases, the South African Air Force was 75,000 men strong. So the Rhodesian Air Force, 1,000 guys, South African Air Force, 75,000 guys. The South African Air Force had more than 300 combat aircraft at its peak. And now in the Ukraine war, Ukraine has got a population that is 10 times the size of the white population of South Africa. And to me, it's as if the Ukrainian Air Force in 2022 and so on is smaller than the South African Air Force of the 1980s. And the South African Air Force didn't just have old stuff, they had good stuff. They had French MiG jets, etc. The South African Air Force is a whole different kettle of fish on a whole other level. So what you've got in Rhodesia is you've got a little hodgepodge Air Force that is run by a couple of whites, that is a tiny Air Force for a small group of whites, 250,000 whites. And our helicopters, our main helicopter is the helicopter that you see up there on the top left. That's the Alouette. But then you'll see all these other strange looking little aircraft that you'll see here on the right hand side. And they are a whole other story. And they're all propeller driven aircraft. And the way that the Rhodesian Air Force evolved over time will actually shock you and surprise you. It started off with jets and the helicopters, and as time went by, it evolved to propeller driven aircraft. And you would say that is going backwards, that the Rhodesian Air Force is going backwards. They're going from jets to propeller driven aircraft. And I don't think that has ever happened since World War II. But that is a very interesting evolution, and those particular kinds of propeller-driven aircraft, they are a whole topic by themselves. And the Air Force became bigger and bigger, but it didn't become bigger with the jets, because we couldn't buy anything. Those jets that we had from the British from back in the 60s, that was all we had. And if a jet crashed or was shot down, that was it. then it's gone and we've got one less jet. And we can't get more jets. And we can't get jets from South Africa. And there are things that we can't get. We can't get them. And maybe also they wouldn't really function. Like the South African types of aircraft were much more advanced, much more technically demanding. So when we lost a jet, we lost it for good. That's it. One less and no more. So if it crashes, if it's shot down, that's one less aircraft. We just got to carry on with what we got. But the interesting thing is the growth of those propeller-driven aircraft. So as we are losing some jets here and there, the propeller-driven aircraft are becoming more and more. And they're nothing fancy. If you look at them, they're very ordinary-looking aircraft. They are not military aircraft, actually. And then we've got those Alouette helicopter gunships, and that's the whole Air Force. That is what it was composed of. And as the years go by, it's fighting more and more. It's got lots of fighting to do, and that is an actual little combat Air Force that saw tons of fighting. And it saw tons of fighting inside the country every day, as well as outside the country. That little air force would also go and attack outside the country. And the blacks would have Russian anti-aircraft guns. They'd have ground-to-air missiles that they could hold, shoulder-fired ground-to-air missiles. They would have anti-aircraft guns. And our little air force would have to go and face dangerous ground-to-air fire when they go outside the country. So it was pretty hectic for that little air force. So in these photos, you can see actual photos of those same aircraft. There you can see a Alouette helicopter gunship on the top left. And that particular one is probably armed with a 20mm cannon. So that was quite some serious firepower there. That's more than just a normal machine gun. That's a 20mm cannon. And some of those 20mm guns that those Alouettes had actually came out of those old Vampire jets. They actually took the old Vampire 20mm guns and put it into the helicopter. And that gun has got such a tremendous kick that the helicopter physically shudders and lifts when that gun goes off. But that particular weapon is a killer. It fires explosive shells. That's some pretty hectic firepower for those fire force actions. On the bottom left, you can see a Canberra bomber. Those Canberras were very old. They're a very old aircraft, and they were used for bombing runs only. And they were already almost falling apart. They were really old aircraft, but they did tons and tons of work, those old aircraft. They were used mostly for cross-border raids. So, bottom right is a Alouette helicopter taking off. And that one's got twin machine guns. You'll see twin machine guns. And in the background, that vehicle that you see in the background, that's a Rhodesian-built, one of those Rhodesian-built armored cars. And then on the top, there you'll get a bit of an idea of those little propeller-driven aircraft. There you can see a little propeller-driven aircraft, and that actually fights. That's an actual little fighting aircraft. Underneath its wings, it's actually got SNEB rockets. We probably got those SNEB rockets from South Africa because all of our weaponry and stuff came from South Africa, and the South Africans had SNEB rockets. And then above the wing, it's actually got two machine guns. That's actually two machine guns on the top of that little aircraft. We will discuss these kinds of aircraft later. But that'll give you an idea of the Rhodesian Air Force. It's sort of variations on aircraft, and the kinds of things that it had. These are the things that whites put together in their desperation and with their creativity, and these things killed. So anyway, returning to the topic of who killed the most blacks, for a very, very long time I believed it was the Zulu Scouts, because of what was said and written in the final years of the war. However, about 10 years ago, somebody actually wrote a book, somebody from the Air Force wrote a very interesting book, and we might revisit that book, maybe even as an audio book. They wrote a very interesting book about the internals of the Air Force and what the Rhodesian Air Force did. And there is actually a hell of a story behind this little Air Force. This little Air Force did amazing things, and there were all kinds of inventions and things that came out of the guys in this Air Force. There were guys in the Air Force who invented things and designed things. There were some kinds of bombs, for example. There's a thing known as a Golf bomb that I used to think was produced by South Africa. And South Africa did indeed have Golf bombs. But it turned out that those bombs were actually invented originally in Rhodesia. They were bombs that fall and they bounce in the air. They break up and they look like golf balls, and they bounce into the air after they've fallen and they explode. And those bombs are designed to kill people. They're designed to kill the maximum number of people when they explode on the ground. And there are all kinds of things that came out of this little Air Force, this Rhodesian Air Force. And it's actually a hell of a fascinating story, the Rhodesian Air Force, this tiny, tiny little Air Force. And the guy who wrote the book was quite a high-ranking guy, and he himself was a key player in many of these inventions. And he tried all kinds of weird things. Anyhow, he tells a fascinating story at the end of his book. At the end of the time of Rhodesia, when we were handing over to the blacks, and there were all these talks and all political negotiation that whites engaged in southern Africa, whether it's Rhodesia, whether it's South Africa, whether it's the Portuguese, all negotiation is a load of crap, okay? It's just a load of bullshit, it's a load of total crap. All political negotiation is a scam, it's a waste of time, total garbage. But anyway, there were lots and lots of negotiations and talks between the whites and the blacks. South Africa was there helping the Rhodesians. But anyway, they then had these black politicians, but also the blacks who commanded the various black units and the various black armies. And one day, this guy was talking to these blacks who previously had been our top enemies. So he's now talking to the black generals and the top black commanders who are the best of the blacks that we fought. And one day, the topic comes up as he's talking to the blacks. The topic comes up, you know, which units of the Rhodesian military were the ones that scared the blacks the most, that caused the blacks the most pain. And the blacks turned around unanimously, and the blacks said to him, the Air Force. The Air Force was the thing that scared the shit out of them. And this guy said to them, but no, but what about, you know, the RLI? What about the RLI? You know, they fought you. What about the Zulu Scouts and all that? And the blacks were absolutely adamant. The blacks said, no, it's the air power that scared them. It's the helicopters, it's the aircraft. That's the stuff that really fucked them up. That the aircraft were the things that scared them shitless. That nothing scared them like the aircraft. And then he would cite battles that they'd had, and he'd say, yeah, but look at that battle over there, you know, the things that happened there. And the blacks are like, yeah, but you had helicopters there. And, you know, what about that battle over there? No, you had aircraft over there. And the blacks continuously pointed out that the freaking thing that was killing them, the thing that was slaughtering them and was scaring them shitless, was this little air force. This little air force was kicking the crap out of the blacks. And nothing put the fear of God into the blacks like this little air force. Right to the end, the blacks shat bricks, and they said, that little air force, nothing fucked them up like that little air force. So it wasn't the Zulu Scouts. The Zulu Scouts didn't scare them. The RLI didn't scare them. The artillery didn't scare them. The armored vehicles didn't scare them. The thing that scared the blacks shitless was this tiny little whites-only air force. This air force scared the crap out of them. And this air force hurt them like nothing else that the Rhodesian military had. So, it wasn't the sneaking around in the bush. Even other things that the whites and the Zulu Scouts did, we poisoned blacks, we led blacks into ambushes, we killed them in all sorts of ways. None of those things, poisoning the blacks, none of those things scared the blacks. What scared the blacks was the white man's technology. The white man's technology and the white man's ability to move through the air and to kill from the air. That put the fear of God into the blacks. They just couldn't handle that. So let's return to those news announcements where the government said that 70% of all the blacks, all the terrorists who'd been killed during the war, were killed by the Zulu Scouts. Why did the Rhodesian government make that announcement in the final years of the war? And as I recall, it was very, very, very close to the end when the blacks were just about to take over. It was like a couple of months or a couple of weeks before the blacks were going to take over the government that this thing suddenly came out all over the airwaves and everybody printed it and there it was. What is the purpose of putting out something that is false? Why did the Rhodesian government make a false statement, tell a lie? It's not something that I ever asked any of the military people, and they probably themselves wouldn't know. But I think that the only reason that it was done was because the Zulu Scouts had a lot of blacks in it. A huge chunk of the Zulu Scouts were blacks because, like I said, on many occasions you'd have whites and blacks working together in the bush. The reason you had whites and blacks was so that the blacks, being real blacks, could go and meet other blacks and they could meet terrorists. And in many cases, they were blacks. The blacks who were on our side were blacks that we had captured recently. And then we'd said to them, listen, we can toss you in jail for, 10 years or however long, or you can join the Zulu Scouts and fight for us. And most of those blacks, the vast majority of them, said, yeah, we'll fight for you. So the Zulu Scouts would take these blacks and quickly train them, and then they'd have these blacks and they would use them within a short period of time. So those blacks would go back into the bush, but they'd go back to the very area that they came from. So that way they would be known to the other blacks. This is very important. And then that way they could come up with something and say, oh, I was lost during that gunfight and I've come back now, etc., etc. then the other blacks know it, and then they can introduce this guy back to other terrorists. So then this guy, being known in the community, will then be introduced to the other terrorists, and so now it's like, oh, here he is, he's back again. But meanwhile, he's working for the whites, and he needs to sneak away to meet, let's call it, with his white handler. And so the white handler is also made up like a black guy, but because he's white, his eyes, his nose, his hair, those things can be giveaways. So he's there, but he can't just go and interact too closely with all the blacks. So that's why they need a black to get to the other blacks. So it's a whole business of one black meeting another black, and they've got to know each other because they function in the same area. So the blacks who are there, they all know each other. It's sort of like people from the same suburb in a city. So there's a lot of trust and a lot of personal knowledge, and that's important for the blacks to be able to function. Trust is a very important thing that you need in warfare. So what comes out of this is that the black Zulu scout and the white Zulu scout then work together, and the black guy will talk to the others and he'll say, listen, I got another buddy, and that kind of thing. And they will then set up meetings and things, but the meetings are really ambushes, and the white guy and the black guy then have to kill the other blacks. So that is the nature of how they functioned. So the point is that there were lots of these blacks who'd been in the Zulu Scouts, and now Rhodesia is handing over power to the blacks totally. And the blacks are going to be in charge of everything. So I think what was happening there was that the Rhodesian government, as a final move, that the Rhodesian government wanted to spread paranoia among the blacks, that they wanted to scare the blacks. Because by saying to them, oh, well, you see, the Zulu Scouts, they killed 70%. First and foremost, that is a really, really big number. And secondly, the inference from that is that, hold on, but almost half of the Zulu Scouts were blacks. And so the thing then becomes, can we trust those blacks who were in the Zulu Scouts? We don't know who they were. And they did work for the whites. And they can kill you. And I think that was the real goal behind that announcement. That is my best guess, is that that is the goal that they wanted. They wanted to leave the blacks with a message that will trouble them, and they will never really know the answer. And they may begin to wonder, you know, if someone gets murdered here or something happens over there, you know, could this be a Zulu scout, a black Zulu scout, that's still taking orders from a white? That kind of thing. I think that is really what they were up to by making that announcement. The only problem is that people then began to believe that that announcement actually was factual. And you've got to understand that in all warfare, all conflict, you need to lie and you need to engage in deception. And when you've been fighting someone, you know what? Anything is there to be used for that purpose. So you will lie to your enemy, and that's all part and parcel of life. And for us to hand over the whole freaking country to the blacks, what a disaster that was. Just like in South Africa. Big freaking disaster. But that is the situation which we found ourselves in. But anyway, I think that is the real reason why the Rhodesian government made that strange statement right there in the final days and months of white rule. I think it was to leave the blacks with a sense of paranoia. And maybe the blacks even went around hunting down guys that they thought were black Zulu scouts. You never know what they did as a result of that. We don't know. So anyway, the real killing machine was the Rhodesian Air Force. And that makes me feel very happy to know that indeed the white man's technology worked like a bomb. Literally. On another day, I can go into more detail about the Rhodesian Air Force. They got up to all kinds of wild stuff. And there are many things that the army got up to, everybody got up to, that was pretty freaking wild. But some of that Air Force stuff is really fascinating. So in the African bush, where you don't really have roads and things, the Rhodesian Air Force really came into its own. It could fight in that kind of terrain, and that really helped to even up the odds a lot. But I really do want to revisit the whole issue of why whites are losing, why whites lost wars, why is it that we had to go to such tremendous lengths to win a war, and we put so much effort into it, and we still ended up losing on the battlefield. That is going to be a very important discussion that I want to tackle, because actually it's much easier for whites everywhere to win. It's a lot easier than you think. And the real problem is not our weapons, it's not even ourselves. It's got to do with the way that we think, and I'm going to return to that topic. So yeah, when I was a kid, I would hear the sounds of those aircraft. I'd sometimes hear and see the jets going by. The jets didn't fly by that often. The most common thing that I saw were those helicopters that fly across our farm, and I loved running out to go and see them. Or I might be outside and I'd hear that distinctive sound of the alouette, and I'd look up or I'd run to a vantage point. Because there were quite a few trees, I might run to a place where I can get a better look at it and see them flying by. And I must tell you, when I think about these things, I actually have to re-record these sentences over and over again, because I get quite emotional when I think about that time. In my mind's eye, I can still see those kinds of things. That thing, when they heard those aircraft or those helicopters, they knew that the white man's death machines are on their way. Death is coming to pay them a visit, and death is coming from the air. And I should just add into this discussion that in the 1970s, I think it was, in Western military circles, they debated a lot about the future of warfare. This is in America and in Europe. They debated the future of warfare, and they wondered which weapons will be the deadliest in warfare in the future. And a core part of the debate was tanks versus helicopters. Which weapon was going to be the deadliest? Tanks versus helicopters. They were wondering on the future battlefield whether tanks would dominate the battlefield or whether helicopters would dominate the battlefield. And there was a lot of arguing in high positions in Western militaries as to which of these two weapons would dominate. And there were people making the case for the tank, and there were people making the case for the helicopter. The Americans used helicopters to an incredible degree in Vietnam, probably more than in any other war in history. But here in Africa, where the terrain is more difficult, especially in Rhodesia, where armored vehicles virtually had no use at all because they can't drive around in the bush, in Africa, the aircraft became a most important weapon. The aircraft was much more potent than the tank. And in a place like Rhodesia and in Angola and Mozambique, there's no place for armored vehicles there. It's the helicopter that dominates the battlefield. Its ability to land and to hover and to move around in those difficult pieces of terrain, that is really what makes the helicopter awesome. Interestingly enough, Sikorsky, the guy who invented the helicopter, maybe in the Western world, because the Germans actually invented helicopters also, and they had working, functioning helicopters in World War II that people don't even know about. But Sikorsky, who was a big inventor of helicopters, I think in America, Sikorsky made the point about the helicopter versus the aircraft, where he said, you know what? A helicopter will never be able to fly faster than an aircraft. A helicopter will never be able to fly higher than an aircraft. The helicopter can never actually outperform an aircraft, but the helicopter can do things that an aircraft cannot do. And when it comes to warfare, it is this flexibility of the helicopter, to be able to do weird things that no aircraft can do, that puts it in a category of its own. And nowadays, the military helicopter is a really potent weapon. Now, these Rhodesian helicopters, these are really simple, cheap, old things that the whites of Rhodesia put together. But you can't compare this with the stuff the South Africans got up to. That's a whole other story. But it's not the helicopter per se that killed the most blacks. We cannot say which weapon killed the most blacks, because, believe it or not, things like these old Canberras that you see there, those old Canberras, when they were used to do bombing runs on blacks, especially with those Gulf bombs, they could kill blacks by the hundreds at a time. And then, of course, you have the little ground attack aircraft. And you also have the Hawker Hunter, which is not in these photos. The Hawker Hunter could dive in, it could strafe on the ground, and even those old vampire jets. But another weapon that fought a lot was the Hawker Hunter. The Hawker Hunter fought a lot. That thing dived in and did heavy fighting as well. So between the helicopters, the Canberra bombers, the Hawker Hunters, and even these little planes, these little civilian-type planes that are converted for combat use, between all of them, let me tell you, they killed blacks like crazy. They all killed blacks like crazy. And even those old Hawker Hunters and those Canberra bombers that you see there, let me tell you, they killed stacks of blacks. Those planes slaughtered blacks like you cannot believe. So I must tell you, for me, it was really great to figure this out and find this out eventually, because I sat back and I thought, yeah, the white man's technology. Yeah, in the end, the white man's technology came through. That all this other weird, creepy stuff, sneaking around, ambushing blacks, poisoning blacks, none of that really did the kind of work that these things invented by the white man, these wonderful inventions of the European people, these things freaking work. This is Death on Wings. Death on Wings brought to you by the European people, and it certainly scared these blacks shitless when they faced the wings of death and they heard those noises. They knew there's going to be a lot of dying today. Lots of people on our side are going to die today. because the white man's birds of prey have arrived.
And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, thank the whites, you know you don't.